bone together and keeps us safe. Natu, you have marked that witch as your own, and Diana, you have offered your witch's blood, your power, to a vampire. You have turned your back on your own kind and pledged yourself to a creature who is your enemy. It was a kiss, I said, shaken. It was an oath. And having made this promise to each other, you are outlaws. May the gods help you both.
Then we are outlaws, Matthew said quietly. Should we leave, Isabeau?
There was a vulnerable child's voice behind the man's, and something inside me broke for making him choose between us.
His mother strode forward and slapped him hard across the face.
How dare you ask that question?
Mother and son both looked shocked.
The mark of Isabeau's slender hand stood out against Matthew's cheek for a split second, red, then blue, before it faded.
You are my most beloved son, she continued, her voice as strong as iron, and Diana is now my daughter. My responsibility as well as yours. Your fight is my fight. Your enemies are my enemies.
You don't have to shelter us, Mama.
Matthew's voice was as taut as a bowstring.
Enough of that nonsense. You are going to be hounded to the ends of the earth because of this love you share. We fight as a family.
Isabeau turned to me.
As for you, daughter, you will fight as you promised. You are reckless. The truly brave always are, but I cannot fault your courage. Still, you need him as much as you need the air you breathe, and he wants you as he's wanted nothing and no one since I made him. So it is done, and we will make the best of it.
Isabeau unexpectedly pulled me toward her and pressed her cold lips to my right cheek, then my left. I'd been living under the woman's roof for days, but this was my official welcome. She looked coolly at Matthew and made her real point.
The way we will make the best of it begins with Diana behaving like a witch and not some pathetic human. The women of the de Clermont family defend themselves.
Matthew bristled.
I'll see that she's safe.
This is why you are always losing at chess, Mathieu.
Isabeau shook her finger at him.
Like Diana, the queen has almost unlimited power. Yet you insist on surrounding her and leaving yourself vulnerable. This is not a game, however, and her weakness puts us all at risk.
Stay out of this, Isabeau, Matthew warned. Nobody is going to force Diana to be something she isn't.
His mother gave an elegant, expressive snort.
Exactly. We are no longer going to let Diana force herself to be a human, which she is not. She is a witch. You are a vampire. If this was not true, we would not be in such a mess. Matthew, mon cher, if the witch is brave enough to want you, she has no reason to fear her own power. You could rip her apart if you wanted to, and so can the ones who will come for you when they realize what you have done.
She is right, Matthew, I said.
Come, we should go inside.
He kept a wary eye on his mother. You're cold, and we need to talk about Oxford. Then we'll tackle the subject of magic.
I need to tell you what happened here, too. If this was going to work, we would have to reveal some of our secrets, such as the possibility that I might turn into running water at any moment.
There's plenty of time for you to tell me everything, said Matthew, leading me toward the chateau.
Mart was waiting for him when he walked through the door. She gave him a fierce hug, as if he'd returned in triumph from battle, and settled us all in front of the salon's blazing fire.
Matthew positioned himself next to me and watched me drink some tea. Every few moments he put his hand on my knee or smoothed the sweater across my shoulders or tucked a bit of hair back into place, as if trying to make up for his brief absence. Once he'd begun to relax, the questions began. They were innocently ordinary in the beginning. Soon the conversation turned to Oxford.
Were Marcus and Miriam in the lab when the break-in was attempted? I asked.
They were, he said, taking a sip from the glass of wine Mart had put beside him. But the thieves didn't get far. The two of them weren't in any real danger.
Thank God, Isabeau murmured, staring at the fire.
What were they looking for?
Information. About you, he said reluctantly. Someone broke into your rooms at New College as well.
There was one secret out in the open.
Fred was horrified, Matthew continued. He assured me they'll put new locks on your doors and a camera in your stairwell.
It's not Fred's fault.
With the new students, all you need to get past the porters is a confident step and a university scarf. But there was nothing for them to take. Were they after my research? The mere thought of such a thing was ridiculous. Who cared enough about the history of alchemy to engineer a break-in?
You have your computer with your research notes on it.
Matthew gripped my hands tighter.
But it wasn't your work they were after. They tore apart your bedroom and the bathroom. We think that they were looking for a sample of your DNA. Hair, skin, fingernail clippings. When they couldn't get into the lab, they went looking in your rooms.
My hand was shaking slightly. I tried to pull it from his grip, not wanting him to know how badly this news had jangled me. Matthew held on.
You're not alone in this, remember?
He fixed his gaze on me. So it wasn't an ordinary burglar. It was a creature, someone who knows about us and about Ashmole 782. He nodded. Well, they won't find much, not in my rooms. When Matthew looked puzzled, I explained. My mother insisted that I clean my hairbrush before leaving for school each morning. It's an ingrained habit. She made me flush the hair down the toilet, my nail clippings too. Matthew now appeared stunned. Isabeau didn't look surprised at all.
Your mother sounds more and more like someone I would have been eager to know, Isabeau said quietly.
Do you remember what she told you? Matthew asked.
Not really.
There were faint memories of sitting on the edge of the bathtub while my mother demonstrated her morning and evening routine, but little more. I frowned with concentration, the flickering recollections growing brighter. I remember counting to 20. Somewhere along the way, I twirled around and said something.
What could she have been thinking? Matthew mused out loud.
Hair and fingernails carry a lot of genetic information. Who knows? My mother was famous for her premonitions. Then again, she could have just been thinking like a bishop. We're not the sanest bunch.
Your mother was not mad, Diana, and not everything can be explained by your modern science, Mathieu. Witches have believed for centuries that hair and fingernails have power, said Isabeau.
Mart murmured in agreement and rolled her eyes at the ignorance of youth.
Witches use them to work spells, Isabeau continued. Binding spells, love magic, they depend on such things.
You told me you weren't a witch, Isabeau, I said, astonished.
I have known many witches over the years. Not one of them would leave a strand of hair or a scrap of her nails for fear that another witch would find them.
My mother never told me. I wondered what other secrets my mother had kept.
Sometimes it's best for a mother to reveal things slowly to her children.
Isabeau's glance flickered from me to her son. Who broke in? I remembered Isabeau's list of possibilities. Vampires tried to get into the lab, but were less sure about your rooms. Marcus thinks it was vampires and witches working together, but I think it was just witches.
Is this why you were so angry? Because those creatures violated my territory?
Yes. We were back to monosyllables. I waited for the rest of the answer. I might overlook a trespasser on my land or in my lab, Diana, but I cannot stand by while someone does it to you. It feels like a threat, and I simply can't. Keeping you safe is instinctive now.
Matthew ran his white fingers through his hair, and a patch stuck out over his ear.
I'm not a vampire, and I don't know the rules. You have to explain how this works, I said, smoothing his hair into place. So it was the break-in at New College that convinced you to be with me? Matthew's hands moved in a flash to rest on either side of my face.
I needed no encouragement to be with you. You say you've loved me since you resisted hitting me with an oar on the river.
His eyes were unguarded.
I've loved you longer than that, since the moment you used magic to take a book from its shelf at the Bodleian. You looked so relieved, and then so terribly guilty.
Isabeau stood, uncomfortable with her son's open affection.
We will leave you.
Mart started rustling at the table, preparing to depart for the kitchens, where she would doubtless begin whipping up a 10-course feast.
No, Maman, you should hear the rest. So you are not merely outlaws?
Isabeau's voice was heavy. She sank back onto her chair.
There's always been animosity between creatures, vampires and witches especially.
But Diana and I have brought those tensions into the open. It's just an excuse, though. The congregation isn't really bothered by our decision to break the covenant.
Stop speaking in riddles, Mathieu, Isabeau said sharply. I'm out of patience with them.
Mathieu looked at me regretfully before he responded. The congregation has become interested in Ashmole 782 and the mystery of how Diana acquired it. Witches have been watching the manuscript for at least as long as I have. They never foresaw that you would be the one to reclaim it, and no one imagined that I would reach you first.
Old fears wriggled to the surface, telling me there was something wrong deep inside me.
If not for Mabon, Mathieu continued, powerful witches would have been in the Bodleian, witches who knew the manuscript's importance. But they were busy with the festival and let their guard down. They left the task to that young witch, and she let you and the manuscript slip through her fingers.
Poor Gillian, I whispered. Peter Knox must be furious with her.
Indeed. Matthew's mouth tightened. But the congregation has been watching you too, for reasons that go well beyond the book and have to do with your power.
How long? I wasn't able to finish my sentence.
Probably your whole life.
Since my parents died.
Unsettling memories from childhood floated back to me, of feeling the tingles of a witch's attention while on the swings at school, and a vampire's cold stare at a friend's birthday party.
They've been watching me since my parents died.
Isabeau opened her mouth to speak, saw her son's face, and thought better of it. If they have you, they'll have the book too, or so they think. You're connected to Ashmole 782 in some powerful way I don't yet understand. I don't believe they do either.
Not even Peter Knox?
Marcus asked around. He's good at wheedling information out of people. As far as we can tell, Knox is still mystified.
I don't want Marcus to put himself at risk, not for me. He needs to stay out of this, Mathieu.
Marcus knows how to take care of himself.
I have things to tell you, too.
I'd lose my nerve entirely if given a chance to reconsider.
Mathieu took both my hands and his nostrils flared slightly.
You're tired, he said, and hungry. Maybe we should wait until after lunch.
You can smell when I'm hungry? I asked incredulously. That's not fair!
Matthew's head tipped back and he laughed. He kept my hands in his, pulling them behind me so that my arms were shaped like wings. This from a witch, who could, if she felt like it, read my thoughts as if they were written on ticker tape. Diana, my darling, I know when you change your mind. I know when you're thinking bad thoughts, like how much fun it would be to jump the paddock fence, and I most definitely know when you're hungry, he said, kissing me to make his point clear.
Speaking of my being a witch, I said, slightly breathless when he was finished, we've confirmed witch water on the list of genetic possibilities.
What?
Mathieu looked at me with concern. When did that happen?
The moment you pulled away from Set Tour.
I wouldn't let myself cry while you were here. Once you were gone, I cried. A lot.
You've cried before, he said thoughtfully, bringing my hands forward again. He turned them over, examining my palms and fingers. The water came out of your hands.
It came out of everywhere, I said. His eyebrows rose in alarm. My hands, my hair, my eyes, my feet, even my mouth. It was like there was no me left, or if there was, I was nothing but water. I thought I'd never taste anything except salt again.
Were you alone?
Matthew's voice turned sharp.
No, no, of course not, I said hurriedly. Mard and your mother were there. They just couldn't get near me.
There was a lot of water, Mathieu. Wind, too.
What made it stop? He asked.
Isabeau.
Mathieu gave his mother a long look.
She sang to me. The vampire's heavy lids dropped, shielding his eyes.
Once she sang all the time.
Thank you, Maman. I waited for him to tell me that she used to sing to him, and that Isabeau hadn't been the same since Philippe died. But he told me none of those things. Instead, he wrapped me up in a fierce hug, and I tried not to mind that he wouldn't trust me with these parts of himself. As the day unfolded, Matthew's happiness at being home was infectious. We moved from lunch to his study. On the floor in front of the fireplace, he discovered most of the places that I was ticklish.
Throughout, he never let me behind the walls he'd so carefully constructed to keep creatures away from his secrets. Once, I reached out with invisible fingers to locate a chink in Matthew's defenses. He looked up at me in surprise. "Did you say something?" he asked. "No," I said, drawing hastily away. We enjoyed a quiet dinner with Isabeau, who followed along in Matthew's light-hearted wake. But she watched him closely, a look of sadness on her face. Putting on my sorry excuse for pajamas after dinner, I worried about the desk drawer and whether my scent would be on the velvet that cushioned the seals, and I steeled myself to say goodnight before Matthew retreated, alone, to his study. He appeared shortly afterward wearing a pair of loose striped pajama bottoms and a faded black t-shirt, with no shoes on his long, slender feet. "Do you want the left side or the right?" he asked casually, waiting by the bedpost with his arms crossed. I wasn't a vampire, but I could turn my head fast enough when it was warranted. "If it doesn't matter to you, I'd prefer the left," he said gravely. "It will be easier for me to relax if I'm between you and the door." I don't care," I stammered. "Then get in and slide over." Matthew took the bedding out of my hand, and I did as he asked. He slid under the sheets behind me with a groan of satisfaction. "This is the most comfortable bed in the house. My mother doesn't believe we need to bother with good mattresses since we spend so little time sleeping. Her beds are purgatorial." "Are you going to sleep with me?" I squeaked, trying and failing to sound as nonchalant as he did. Matthew put his right arm out and hooked me into it until my head was resting on his shoulder. "I thought I might," he said. "I won't actually sleep, though." Snuggled against him, I placed my palm flat on his heart so that I'd know every time it beat. "What will you do?" "Watch you, of course." His eyes were bright. "And when I get tired of doing that, if I get tired of doing that," he dropped a kiss on each eyelid, "I'll read. Will the candles bother you?" "No," I responded. "I'm a sound sleeper. Nothing wakes me up." "I like a challenge," he said softly. "If I'm bored, I'll figure out something that will wake you up." "Do you bore easily?" I teased, reaching up and threading my fingers through the hair at the base of his skull. "You'll have to wait and see," he said with a wicked grin. His arms were cool and soothing, and the feeling of safety in his presence was more restful than any lullaby. "Will this ever stop?" I asked quietly. "The congregation?" Matthew's voice was worried. "I don't know." "No." My head rose in surprise. "I don't care about that." "What do you mean, then?" I kissed him on his quizzical mouth. "This feeling when I'm with you, as if I'm fully alive for the first time." Matthew smiled, his expression uncharacteristically sweet and shy. "I hope not." Sighing with contentment, I lowered my head onto his chest and fell into dreamless sleep. Chapter 27. It occurred to me the next morning that my days with Matthew thus far had fallen into one of two categories. Either he steered the day along, keeping me safe and making sure nothing upset his careful arrangements, or the day unfolded without rhyme or reason. Not long ago, what happened in my day had been determined by carefully drawn up lists and schedules. Today, I was going to take charge. Today, Matthew was going to let me into his life as a vampire. Unfortunately, my decision was bound to ruin what promised to be a wonderful day. It started at dawn, with Matthew's physical proximity, which sent the same shock of desire through me that I'd felt yesterday in the courtyard. It was more effective than any alarm clock. His response was gratifyingly immediate as well, and he kissed me with enthusiasm. "I thought you'd never wake up," he grumbled between kisses. "I feared I would have to send to the village for the town band, and the only trumpeter who knew how to sound reveille died last year." Lying at his side, I noticed he wasn't wearing the Ampulla from Bethany. Where did your pilgrim's badge go? It was the perfect opportunity for him to tell me about the Knights of Lazarus, but he didn't take it. I don't need it anymore, he'd said, distracting me by winding a lock of my hair around his finger and then pulling it to the side so he could kiss the sensitive flesh behind my ear. Tell me, I'd insisted, squirming away slightly. Later, he said, lips drifting down to the place where neck met shoulder. My body foiled any further attempts at rational conversation. We both behaved instinctually, touching through the barriers of thin clothing and noting the small changes, a shiver, an eruption of goose flesh, a soft moan that promised greater pleasure to come. When I became insistent, reaching to seize bare flesh, Matthew stopped me. No rushing. We have time. Vampires, was all I managed to say before he stopped my words with his mouth. We were still behind the bed curtains when Mart entered the room. She left the breakfast tray on the table with an officious clatter and threw two logs on the fire with the enthusiasm of a Scot tossing the caper. Matthew peered out, proclaimed it a perfect morning, and declared that I was ravenous. Mart erupted into a string of oxytocin and departed, humming a song under her breath. He refused to translate on the grounds that the lyrics were too bawdy for my delicate ears. This morning, instead of quietly watching me eat, Matthew complained that he was bored. He did it with a wicked gleam in his eyes, his fingers restless on his thighs. We'll go riding after breakfast, I promised, forking some eggs into my mouth and taking a scalding sip of tea. My work can wait until later. Riding won't fix it, Matthew purred. Kissing worked to drive away his ennui. My lips felt bruised, and I had a much finer understanding of the interconnectedness of my own nervous system when Matthew finally conceded it was time to go riding. He went downstairs to change while I showered. Mart came upstairs to retrieve the tray, and I told her my plans while braiding my hair into a thick rope. Her eyes widened at the important part, but she agreed to set a small pack of sandwiches and a bottle of water out to Georges for Ricasa's saddlebag. After that, there was nothing left but to inform Matthew. He was humming and sitting at his desk, clattering on his computer and occasionally reaching over to thumb through messages on his phone. He looked up and grinned. "There you are," he said. "Thought I was going to have to fish you out of the water." Desire shot through me, and my knees went weak. The feelings were exacerbated by the knowledge that what I was about to say would wipe the smile clean off his face. "Please let this be right," I whispered to myself, resting my hands on his shoulders. Matthew tilted his head back against my chest and smiled up at me. "Kiss me," he commanded. I complied without a second thought, amazed at the comfort between us. This was so different from books and movies, where love was made into something tense and difficult. Loving Matthew was much more like coming into port than heading out into a storm. "How do you manage it?" I asked him, holding his face in my hands. "I feel like I've known you forever." Matthew smiled happily and returned his attention to his computer, shutting down his various programs. While he did, I drank in his spicy scent and smoothed his hair along the curve of his skull. "That feels wonderful," he said, leaning back into my hand. It was time to ruin his day. Crouching down, I rested my chin on his shoulder. "Take me hunting." Every muscle in his body stiffened. "That's not funny, Diana," he said icily. "I'm not trying to be." My chin and hands remained where they were. He tried to shrug me off, but I wouldn't let him. Though I didn't have the courage to face him, he wasn't going to escape. "You need to do this, Matthew. You need to know that you can trust me." He stood up explosively, leaving me no choice but to step back and let him go. Matthew strode away, and one hand strayed to the spot where his Bethany Ampulla used to rest. Not a good sign. "Vampires don't take warm bloods hunting, Diana." This was not a good sign either. He was lying to me. Yes, they do, I said softly. You hunt with Hamish.
That's different. I've known him for years, and I don't share a bed with him.
Matthew's voice was rough, and he was staring fixedly at his bookshelves. I started toward him slowly.
If Hamish can hunt with you, so can I.
No.
The muscles in his shoulders stood out in sharp relief, their outlines visible under his sweater.
Isabeau took me with her.
The silence in the room was absolute. Matthew drew in a single, ragged breath, and the muscles in his shoulder twitched. I took another step.
Don't, he said harshly. I don't want you near me when I'm angry.
Reminding myself that he wasn't in charge today, I took my next steps at a much faster pace and stood directly behind him. That way he couldn't avoid my scent or the sound of my heartbeat, which was measured and steady.
I didn't mean to make you angry.
I'm not angry with you.
He sounded bitter.
My mother, however, has a lot to answer for. She's done a great deal to try my patience over the centuries, but taking you hunting is unforgivable.
Isabeau asked me if I needed to come back to the chateau.
You shouldn't have been given the choice, he barked, whirling around to face me. Vampires aren't in control when they're hunting. Not entirely. My mother certainly isn't to be trusted when she smells blood. For her, it's all about the kill and the feeding. If the wind had caught your scent, she would have fed on you too, without a second thought.
Matthew had reacted more negatively than I'd expected. With one of my feet firmly in the fire, however, the other one might as well go in too.
Your mother was only protecting you. She was concerned that I didn't understand the stakes. You would have done the same for Lucas.
Once again, the silence was deep and long.
She had no right to tell you about Lucas. He belonged to me, not to her.
Matthew's voice was soft, but filled with more venom than I'd ever heard in it. His eyes flickered to the shelf that held the tower.
To you and to Blanca, I said, my voice equally soft.
The life stories of a vampire are theirs to tell, and theirs alone. We may be outlaws, you and I, but my mother has broken a few rules herself in the past few days.
He reached again for the missing Bethany Ampulla.
I crossed the small distance that separated us, moving quietly and surely, as if he were a nervous animal, so as to keep him from lashing out in a way he would regret later. When I was standing no more than an inch from him, I took hold of his arms.
Isabeau told me other things as well. We talked about your father. She told me all of your names, and which ones you don't like, and her names as well.
I don't really understand their significance, but it's not something she tells everyone. And she told me how she made you. The song she sang to make my witch water go away was the same song she sang to you when you were first a vampire.
When you couldn't stop feeding.
Matthew met my eyes with difficulty. They were full of pain and a vulnerability that he'd carefully hidden before now. It broke my heart.
I can't risk it, Diana, he said. I want you. More than anyone I've ever known. I want you physically. I want you emotionally. If my concentration shifts for an instant while we're out hunting, the deer's scent could get confused with yours, and my instinct to hunt an animal could cross with my desire to have you.
You already have me, I said, holding on to him with my hands, my eyes, my mind, my heart. There's no need to hunt me. I'm yours.
It doesn't work that way, he said. I'll never possess you completely. I'll always want more than you can give.
You didn't in my bed this morning. My cheeks reddened at the memory of his latest rebuff. I was more than willing to give myself to you, and you said no.
I didn't say no. I said later.
Is that how you hunt, too? Seduction, delay, then surrender? He shuddered. It was all the answer I required.
Show me, I insisted.
No.
Show me!
He growled, but I stood my ground. The sound was a warning, not a threat.
I know you're frightened. So am I.
Regret flickered in his eyes, and I made a sound of impatience.
For the last time, I'm not frightened of you.
It's my own power that scares me. You didn't see the witch water, Matthew. When the water moved within me, I could have destroyed everyone and everything and not felt a drop of remorse. You're not the only dangerous creature in this room. But we have to learn how to be with each other in spite of who we are. He gave a bitter laugh. Maybe that's why there are rules against vampires and witches being together. Maybe it's too difficult to cross these lines after all.
You don't believe that, I said fiercely, taking his hand in mine and holding it to my face. The shock of cold against warm sent a delicious feeling through my bones, and my heart gave its usual thump of acknowledgement. What we feel for each other is not, cannot be wrong.
Diana, he began, shaking his head and drawing his fingers away. Gripping him more tightly, I turned the palm over. His lifeline was long and smooth, and after tracing it, I brought my fingers to rest on his veins. They looked black under the white skin, and Matthew shivered at my touch. There was still pain in his eyes, but he was not as furious.
This is not wrong. You know it. Now you have to know that you can trust me, too. I laced my fingers through his and gave him time to think, but I didn't let go.
I'll take you hunting, Matthew said at last, provided you don't come near me and don't get down from Mikasa's back. If you get so much as a hint that I'm looking at you, that I'm even thinking about you, turn around and ride straight home to Mart. The decision made, Matthew stalked downstairs, waiting patiently each time he realized I was lagging behind. As he breezed past the door of the salon, Isabeau rose from her seat. Come on, he said tightly, gripping my elbow and steering me downstairs. Isabeau was only a few feet behind us by the time we reached the kitchens, where Mart stood in the doorway to the cold foods larder, eyeing Matthew and me as if watching the latest drama on afternoon television. Neither needed to be told that something was wrong. I don't know when we'll be back, Matthew shot over his shoulder. His fingers didn't loosen, and he gave me no opportunity to do more than turn toward her with an apologetic face and mouth the word sorry.
Elle a plus de courage que je ne le pensais, Isabeau murmured to Mart.
Matthew stopped abruptly, his lip curled in an unpleasant snarl.
Yes, Mother, Diana has more courage than we deserve, you and I. And if you ever test that again, it will be the last time you see either of us. Understood?
Of course, Mathieu,
Isabeau murmured. It was her favorite non-committal response. Matthew didn't speak to me on the way to the stables. Half a dozen times he looked as though he were going to turn around and march us back to the chateau. At the stable door he gripped my shoulders, searching my face and body for signs of fear. My chin went up in the air. Shall we? I motioned toward the paddock. He made a sound of exasperation and shouted for George. Balthazar bellowed in response and caught the apple that I tossed in his direction. Mercifully, I didn't need any help getting my boots on, though it did take me longer than it took Matthew. He watched me carefully as I did up the vest's fastenings and snapped the chin strap on the helmet. Take this, he said, handing me a cropped whip.
I don't need it.
You'll take the crop, Diana.
I took it, and resolved to ditch it in the brush at the first opportunity. And if you toss it aside when we enter the forest, we're coming home.
Did he really think I would use the crop on him?
I shoved it into my boot, the handle sticking out by my knee, and stomped out into the paddock. The horses skittered nervously when we came into view. Like Isabeau, both knew something was wrong. Rakasa took the apple I owed her, and I ran my fingers over her flesh and spoke to her softly in an effort to soothe her. Matthew didn't bother with Dar. He was all business, checking the horse's tack with lightning speed. When I'd finished, Matthew tossed me onto Rakasa's back. His hands were firm around my waist, but he didn't hold on a moment longer than necessary. He didn't want any more of my scent on him. In the forest, Matthew made sure the crop was still in my boot.
Your right stirrup needs shortening, he pointed out, after we had the horses trotting.
He wanted my tack in racing trim, in case I needed to make a run for it. I pulled Rakasa in with a scowl and adjusted the stirrup leathers. The now familiar field opened up in front of me, and Matthew sniffed the air. He grabbed Rakasa's reins and brought me to a halt. He was still black with anger.
There's a rabbit over there. Matthew nodded to the western section of the field.
I've done rabbit, I said calmly, and marmot, and goat, and a doe.
Matthew swore. It was concise and comprehensive, and I hoped we were out of the range of Isabeau's keen ears.
The phrase is cut to the chase, is it not?
I don't hunt deer like my mother does, by frightening it to death and pouncing on it. I can kill a rabbit for you, or even a goat, but I'm not stalking a deer while you're with me.
Matthew's jaw was set in an obstinate line. Stop pretending and trust me. I gestured at my saddlebag. I'm prepared for the wait.
He shook his head. Not with you at my side.
Since I've met you, I said quietly, you've shown me all the pleasant parts of being a vampire. You taste things I can't even imagine. You remember events and people that I can only read about in books. You smell when I change my mind or want to kiss you. You've woken me to a world of sensory possibilities I never dreamed existed.
I paused for a moment, hoping I was making progress. I wasn't.
At the same time, you've seen me throw up, set fire to your rug, and come completely unglued when I received something unexpected in the mail. You missed the waterworks, but they weren't pretty. In return, I'm asking you to let me watch you feed yourself. It's a basic thing, Matthew. If you can't bear it, then we can make the congregation happy and call it off.
Dieu, will you never stop surprising me?
Matthew's head lifted, and he stared into the distance. His attention was caught by a young stag on the crest of the hill. The stag was cropping the grass, and the wind was blowing toward us, so he hadn't yet picked up our scent. Thank you, I breathed silently. It was a gift from the gods for the stag to appear like that. Matthew's eyes locked on his prey, and the anger left him to make room for a preternatural awareness of his environment. I fixed my eyes on the vampire, watching for the slightest changes that signaled what he was thinking or feeling, but there were precious few clues. Don't you dare move, I warned, when Rakasa tensed in preparation for a fidget. She rooted her hooves into the earth and stood at attention. Matthew smelled the wind change and took Rakasa's reins. He slowly moved both horses to the right, keeping them within the path of the downward breezes. The stag raised his head and looked down the hill, then resumed his quiet clipping of the grass. Matthew's eyes darted over the terrain, lingering momentarily on a rabbit and widening when a fox stuck his head out of a hole. A falcon swooped overhead, riding the breeze like a surfer rides the waves, and he took in that as well. I began to appreciate how he'd managed the creatures in the Bodleian. There wasn't a living thing in this field that he hadn't located, identified, and been prepared to kill after only a few minutes of observation. Matthew inched the horses toward the trees, camouflaging my presence by putting me in the midst of other animal scents and sounds. While we moved, Matthew noted when the falcon was joined by another bird, or when one rabbit disappeared down a hole and another popped up to take its place. We startled a spotted animal that looked like a cat with a long striped tail. From the pitch of Matthew's body, it was clear he wanted to chase it, and had he been alone, he would have hunted it down before turning to the stag. With difficulty, he drew his eyes away from the animal's leaping form. It took us almost an hour to make our way from the bottom of the field around the forest's edge. When we were near the top, Matthew performed his face-forward dismount. He smacked Dar on the rump, and the horse obediently turned and headed for home. Matthew hadn't let go of Rakasa's reins during these maneuvers, and he didn't release them now. He led her to the edge of the forest and drew in a deep breath, taking in every trace of scent. Without a sound, he put us inside a small thicket of low-growing birch. The vampire crouched, both knees bent in a position that would have been excruciating for a human after about 4 minutes. Matthew held it for nearly 2 hours. My feet fell asleep, and I woke them up by flexing my ankles in the stirrups. Matthew hadn't exaggerated the difference between his way of hunting and his mother's. For Isabeau, it was primarily about filling a biological need. She needed blood, the animals had it, and she took it from them as efficiently as possible, without feeling remorse that her survival required the death of another creature.
For her son, however, it was clearly more complicated. He, too, needed the physical nourishment that their blood provided. But Matthew felt a kinship with his prey that reminded me of the tone of respect I'd detected in his articles about the wolves. For Matthew, hunting was primarily about strategy, about pitting his feral intelligence against something that thought and sensed the world as he did. Remembering our play in bed that morning, my eyes closed against a sudden jolt of desire. I wanted him as badly here in the forest when he was about to kill something as I had this morning, and I began to understand what worried Matthew about hunting with me. Survival and sexuality were linked in ways I'd never appreciated until now. He exhaled softly and left my side without warning, his body prowling through the edges of the forest. When Matthew loped across the ridge, the stag raised his head, curious to see what this strange creature was. It took the stag only a few seconds to assess Matthew as a threat, which was longer than it would have taken me. My hair was standing on end, and I felt the same pull of concern for the stag that I had for Isabeau's deer. The stag sprang into action, leaping down the hillside, but Matthew was faster, and he cut the animal off before it could get too close to where I was hiding. He chased it up the hill and back across the ridge. With every step, Matthew drew closer, and the stag became more anxious. "I know that you're afraid," I said silently, hoping the stag could hear me. "He needs to do this. He doesn't do this for sport or to harm you. He does it to stay alive." Rakasa's head swung around, and she eyed me nervously. I reached down to reassure her and kept my hand on her neck. "Be still," I urged the stag. "Stop running. Not even you are fast enough to outrun this creature." The stag slowed, stumbling over a hole in the ground. He was running straight for me, as if he could hear my voice and was following it to its source. Matthew reached and grabbed the stag's horns, twisting his head to one side. The stag fell on his back, his sides heaving with exertion. Matthew sank to his knees, holding its head securely about 20 feet from the thicket. The stag tried to kick its way to his feet. "Let go," I said sadly. "It's time. This is the creature who will end your life." The stag gave a final kick of frustration and fear and then quieted. Matthew stared deep into the eyes of his prey, as if waiting for permission to finish the job, then moved so swiftly that there was nothing more than a blur of black and white as he battened onto the stag's neck. As he fed, the stag's life seeped away, and a surge of energy entered Matthew. There was a clean tang of iron in the air, though no drops of blood fell. When the stag's life force was gone, Matthew remained still, kneeling quietly next to the carcass with his head bowed. I kicked Rakasa into a walk. Matthew's back stiffened at my approach. He looked up, his eyes pale gray-green and bright with satisfaction. Taking the crop out of my boot, I threw it as far as I could in the opposite direction. It sailed into the underbrush and became hopelessly entangled in the gorse. Matthew watched with interest, but the danger that he might mistake me for a doe had clearly passed. Deliberately, I took off my helmet and dismounted with my back turned. Even now I trusted him, though he didn't trust himself. Resting my hand lightly on his shoulder, I dropped to my knees and put the helmet down near the stag's staring eyes. "I like the way you hunt better than the way Isabeau does it. So does the deer, I think."
"How does my mother kill that is so different from me?"
Matthew's French accent was stronger, and his voice sounded even more fluid and hypnotic than usual. He smelled different, too. "She hunts out of biological need," I said simply. "You hunt because it makes you feel wholly alive. And you two reached an agreement." I motioned at the stag. "He was at peace, I think, in the end." Matthew looked at me intently, snow turning to ice on my skin as he stared.
"Were you talking to this stag as you talked to Balthazar and Rakasa?"
"I didn't interfere, if that's what you're worried about," I said hastily. "The kill was yours." Maybe such things mattered to vampires. Matthew shuddered.
"I don't keep score." He dragged his eyes from the stag and rose to his feet in one of those smooth movements that marked him unmistakably as a vampire. A long, slender hand reached down.
Come, you're cold kneeling on the ground.
I placed my hand in his and stood, wondering who would get rid of the stag's carcass. Some combination of Georges and Mart would be involved. Rakasa was contentedly eating grass, unconcerned by the dead animal lying so close. Unaccountably, I was ravenous.
Rakasa, I called silently. She looked up and walked over.
Do you mind if I eat? I asked hesitantly, unsure what Matthew's reaction would be.
His mouth twitched.
No. Given what you've seen today, the least I can do is watch you have a sandwich.
There's no difference, Matthew. I undid the buckle on Rakasa's saddlebag and said a silent word of thanks.
Mart, bless her, had packed cheese sandwiches. The worst of my hunger checked, I brushed the crumbs from my hands. Matthew was watching me like a hawk.
Do you mind? He asked quietly.
Mind what?
I'd already told him I didn't mind about the deer.
Blanca and Lucas. That I was married and had a child once, so long ago.
I was jealous of Blanca, but Matthew wouldn't understand how or why. I gathered my thoughts and emotions and tried to sort them into something that was both true and would make sense to him.
I don't mind one moment of love that you've shared with any creature, living or dead, I said emphatically, so long as you want to be with me right at this moment.
Just at this moment? He asked, his eyebrow arching up into a question mark.
This is the only moment that matters. It all seemed so simple.
No one who has lived as long as you have comes without a past, Matthew. You weren't a monk, and I don't expect you to have no regrets about who you've lost along the way. How could you not have been loved before, when I love you so much?
Matthew gathered me to his heart. I went eagerly, glad that the day's hunting hadn't ended in disaster and that his anger was fading. It still smoldered. It was evident in a lingering tightness in his face and shoulders, but it no longer threatened to engulf us. He cupped my chin in his long fingers and tilted my face up to his.
Would you mind very much if I kissed you?
Matthew glanced away for a moment when he asked.
Of course not. I stood on tiptoes so that my mouth was closer to his. Still, he hesitated, so I reached up and clasped my hands behind his neck.
Don't be idiotic. Kiss me.
He did, briefly but firmly. The final traces of blood were still on his lips, but it was neither frightening nor unpleasant. It was just Matthew.
You know there won't be any children between us, he said, while he held me close, our faces nearly touching. Vampires can't father children the traditional way. Do you mind that?
There's more than one way to make a child.
Children weren't something I'd thought about before.
Isabeau made you, and you belong to her no less than Lucas belonged to you and Blanca. And there are a lot of children in the world who don't have parents.
I remembered the moment when Sarah and Em told me mine were gone and never coming back.
We could take them in, a whole coven of them, if we wanted to.
I haven't made a vampire for years, he said. I can still manage it, but I hope you don't intend that we have a large family.
My family has doubled in the past 3 weeks, with you, Mart, and Isabeau added. I don't know how much more family I can take.
You need to add one more to that number.
My eyes widened.
There are more of you?
Oh, there are always more, he said dryly.
Vampire genealogies are much more complicated than witch genealogies, after all. We have blood relations on three sides, not just two. But this is a member of the family that you've already met.
Marcus? I asked, thinking of the young American vampire and his high tops.
Matthew nodded.
He'll have to tell you his own story. I'm not as much of an iconoclast as my mother, despite falling in love with a witch. I made him more than 200 years ago, and I'm proud of him and what he's done with his life.
But you didn't want him to take my blood in a lab, I said with a frown. He's your son. Why couldn't you trust him with me? parents were supposed to trust their children.
It was made with my blood, my darling, Matthew said, looking patient and possessive at the same time. If I find you so irresistible, why wouldn't he?
Remember, none of us is immune to the lure of blood. I might trust him more than I would a stranger, but I'll never be completely at ease when any vampire is too close to you.
Not even Mart?
I was aghast. I trusted Mart completely.
Not even Mart, he said firmly. You really aren't her type at all, though. She prefers her blood from far brawnier creatures.
You don't have to worry about Mart or Isabeau either.
I was equally firm.
Be careful with my mother, Matthew warned. My father told me never to turn my back on her, and he was right. She's always been fascinated by and envious of witches. Given the right circumstances and the right mood... He shook his head.
And then there's what happened to Philippe.
Matthew froze.
I'm seeing things now, Matthew. I saw Isabeau tell you about the witches who captured your father. She has no reason to trust me, but she let me in her house anyway. The real threat is the congregation, and there would be no danger from them if you made me into a vampire.
His face darkened. My mother and I are going to have a long talk about appropriate topics of conversation.
You can't keep the world of vampires, your world, away from me. I'm in it. I need to know how it works and what the rules are.
My temper flared, seething down my arms and toward my nails, where it erupted into arcs of blue fire.
Matthew's eyes widened. You aren't the only scary creature around, are you?
I waved my fiery hands between us until the vampire shook his head.
So stop being all heroic and let me share your life. I don't want to be with Sir Lancelot. Be yourself, Matthew Claremont, complete with your sharp vampire teeth and your scary mother, your test tubes full of blood and your DNA, your infuriating bossiness and your maddening sense of smell.
Once I had spit all that out, the blue sparks retreated from my fingertips. They waited somewhere around my elbows in case I needed them again.
If I come closer, Matthew said conversationally, as though asking for the time or the temperature, will you turn blue again, or is that it for now?
I think I'm done for the time being.
You think? His eyebrow arched again.
I'm perfectly under control, I said with more conviction, remembering with regret the hole in his rug in Oxford.
Matthew had his arms around me in a flash.
Oof, I complained as he crushed my elbows into my ribs.
And you are going to give me gray hairs. Long thought impossible among vampires, by the way, with your courage, your firecracker hands, and the impossible things you say.
To make sure he was safe from the last, Matthew kissed me quite thoroughly. When he was finished, I was unlikely to say much, surprising or otherwise. My ear rested against his sternum, listening patiently for his heart to thump. When it did, I gave him a satisfied squeeze, glad not to be the only one whose heart was full.
You win, ma vaillante fille, he said, cradling me against his body. I will try not to coddle you so much. And you must not underestimate how dangerous vampires can be.
It was hard to put danger and vampire into the same thought while pressed so firmly against him.
Rikasa gazed at us indulgently, the grass spouting out of both sides of her mouth.
Are you finished?
I angled back my head to look at him.
If you're asking if I need to hunt more, the answer is no.
Rikasa is going to explode. She's been eating grass for quite some time, and she can't carry both of us.
My hands took stock of Matthew's hips and buttocks. His breath caught in his throat, making a very different kind of purring sound from the one he made when he was angry.
You ride, and I'll walk alongside, he suggested, after another very thorough kiss.
Let's both walk.
After hours in the saddle, I wasn't eager to get back up on Rikasa.
It was twilight when Matthew led us back through the chateau gates. Set Tour was ablaze, every lamp illuminated in silent greeting.
Home, I said, my heart lifting at the sight.
Matthew looked at me rather than the house and smiled.
Home.
Chapter 28.
Safely back at the chateau, we ate in the housekeeper's room before a blazing fire.
"Where's Isabeau?" I asked Mart when she had brought me a fresh cup of tea.
"Out."
She stalked back toward the kitchen.
"Out where?"
"Mart," Matthew called. "We're not trying to keep things from Diana." She turned and glared. I couldn't decide if it was directed at him, his absent mother, or me.
"She went to the village to see that priest. The mayor, too."
Mart stopped, hesitated, and started again.
"Then she was going to clean."
"Clean what?" I wondered.
"The woods, the hills, the caves."
Mart seemed to think this explanation was sufficient, but I looked at Matthew for clarification.
Mart sometimes confuses clean and clear. The light from the fire caught the facets of his heavy goblet. He was having some of the fresh wine from down the road, but he didn't drink as much as usual.
It would seem that Maman has gone out to make sure there are no vampires lurking around Set Tool.
"Is she looking for anyone in particular?"
"Domenico, of course. And one of the congregation's other vampires, Gerbert. He's also from the Auvergne, from Aurillac. She'll look in some of his hiding places, just to make sure he isn't nearby."
"Gerbert? From Aurillac? The Gerbert of Aurillac? The 10th century pope who reputedly owned a brass head that spoke oracles?" The fact that Gerbert was a vampire and had once been pope was of much less interest to me than was his reputation as a student of science and magic.
"I keep forgetting how much history you know. You put even vampires to shame. Yes, that Gerbert." "And," he warned, "I would like it very much if you'd stay out of his way. If you do meet him, no quizzing him about Arabic medicine or astronomy. He's always been acquisitive when it comes to witches and magic."
Matthew looked at me possessively.
"Does Isabeau know him?"
"Oh, yes. They were thick as thieves once. If he's anywhere near here, she'll find him. But you don't have to worry he'll come to the chateau," Matthew assured me. "He knows he's not welcome here. Stay inside the walls unless one of us is with you."
"Don't worry, I won't leave the grounds. Gerbert of Aurillac was not someone I wanted to stumble upon unexpectedly."
"I suspect she's trying to apologize for her behavior."
Matthew's voice was neutral, but he was still angry.
"You're going to have to forgive her," I said again. "She didn't want you to be hurt. I'm not a child, Diana, and my mother doesn't need to protect me from my own wife." He kept turning his glass this way and that. The word wife echoed in the room for a few moments.
"Did I miss something?" I finally asked. "When were we married?"
Matthew's eyes lifted. "The moment I came home and said I loved you. It wouldn't stand up in court, perhaps, but as far as vampires are concerned, we're wed."
"Not when I said I loved you, and not when you said you loved me on the phone. It only happened when you came home and told me to my face?" This was something that demanded precision. I was planning on starting a new file on my computer with the title Phrases That Sound One Way to Witches But Mean Something Else to Vampires.
"Vampires mate the way lions do, or wolves," he explained, sounding like a scientist in a television documentary. "The female selects a mate, and once the male has agreed, that's it. They're mated for life, and the rest of the community acknowledges their bond."
"Ah," I said faintly. We were back to the Norwegian wolves.
"I've never liked the word mate, though. It always sounds impersonal, as if you're trying to match up socks or shoes."
Matthew put his goblet down and crossed his arms, resting them on the scarred surface of the table.
"But you're not a vampire. Do you mind that I think of you as my wife?"
A small cyclone whipped around my brain as I tried to figure out what my love for Matthew had to do with the deadlier members of the animal kingdom and a social institution that I'd never been particularly enthusiastic about.
In the whirlwind, there were no warning signs or guideposts to help me find my way. And when two vampires mate, I inquired when I could manage it, is it expected that the female will obey the male just like the rest of the pack? I'm afraid so, he said, looking down at his hands. I narrowed my eyes at his dark, bowed head. What do I get out of this arrangement? Love, honor, guard, and keep, he said, finally daring to meet my eyes. That sounds an awful lot like a medieval wedding service. A vampire wrote that part of the liturgy, but I'm not going to make you serve me, he assured me hastily with a straight face. That was put in to make the humans happy. The men, at least. I don't imagine it put a smile on the faces of the women. Probably not, he said, attempting a lopsided grin. Nerves got the better of him, and it collapsed into an anxious look instead. His gaze returned to his hands. The past seemed gray and cold without Matthew, and the future promised to be much more interesting with him in it. No matter how brief our courtship, I certainly felt bound to him. And, given vampires' pack behavior, it wasn't going to be possible to swap obedience for something more progressive, whether he called me wife or not. I feel I should point out, husband, that, strictly speaking, your mother wasn't protecting you from your wife. The words husband and wife felt strange on my tongue. I wasn't your wife, under the terms laid out here, until you came home. Instead, I was just some creature you left, like a package with no forwarding address. Given that, I got off lightly. A smile hovered at the corners of his mouth. You think so? Then I suppose I should honor your wishes and forgive her. He reached for my hand and carried it to his mouth, brushing the knuckles with his lips. I said you were mine. I meant it. This is why Isabeau was so upset yesterday over our kiss in the courtyard. It explained both her anger and her abrupt surrender. Once you were with me, there was no going back. Not for a vampire. Not for a witch, either. Matthew cut the growing thickness in the air by casting a pointed look at my empty bowl. I'd devoured 3 helpings of stew, insisting all the while I wasn't hungry. Are you finished? He asked. Yes, I grumbled, annoyed at being caught out. It was still early, but my yawns had already begun. We found Mart rubbing down a vast wooden table with a fragrant combination of boiling water, sea salt, and lemons, and we said goodnight. Isabeau will return soon, Matthew told her. She will be out all night, Mart replied darkly, looking up from her lemons. I will stay here. As you like, Mart. He gripped her shoulder for a moment. On the way upstairs to his study, Matthew told me the story of where he bought his copy of Vesalius's anatomy book, and what he thought when he first saw the illustrations. I dropped onto the sofa with the book in question, and happily looked at the pictures of flayed corpses, too tired to concentrate on Aurora Consurgence, while Matthew answered email. The hidden drawer in his desk was firmly closed, I noted with relief. I'm going to take a bath, I said an hour later, rising and stretching my stiff muscles in preparation for climbing more stairs. I needed some time alone to think through the implications of my new status as Matthew's wife. The idea of marriage was overwhelming enough. When you factored in vampire possessiveness and my own ignorance about what was happening, it seemed an ideal time for a moment of reflection. I'll be up shortly, Matthew said, barely looking up from the glow of his computer screen. The bath water was hot and plentiful as ever, and I sank into the tub with a groan of pleasure. Mart had been up and had worked her magic with candles and the fire. The rooms felt cozy, if not precisely warm. I drifted through a satisfying replay of the day's accomplishments. Being in charge was better than letting random events take place. I was still soaking in the bathtub, my hair falling over the edge in a cascade of straw when there was a gentle knock on the door. Matthew pushed it open without waiting for me to respond. Sitting up with a start, I quickly sank back into the water when he walked in. He grabbed one of the towels and held it out like a sail in the wind. His eyes were smoky.
"Come to bed," he said, his voice gruff.
I sat in the water for a few heartbeats, trying to read his face. Matthew stood patiently during my examination, towel extended. After a deep breath, I stood, the water streaming over my naked body. Matthew's pupils dilated suddenly, his body still. Then he stood back to let me step out of the tub before he wrapped the towel around me. Clutching it to my chest, I kept my eyes on him. When they didn't waver, I let the towel fall, the light from the candles glinting off damp skin. His eyes lingered over my body, their slow, cold progress sending a shiver of anticipation down my spine. He pulled me toward him without a word, his lips moving over my neck and shoulders. Matthew breathed in my scent, his long, cool fingers lifting the hair off my neck and back. I gasped when his thumb came to rest against the pulse in my throat.
"Dieu, you are beautiful," he murmured, "and so alive."
He began to kiss me again. Pulling at his t-shirt, my warm fingers moved against his cool, smooth skin. Matthew shuddered. It was much like my reaction to his first cold touches. I smiled against his busy mouth, and he paused with a question on his face.
"It feels nice, doesn't it, when your coldness and my warmth meet?"
Matthew laughed, and the sound was as deep and smoky as his eyes. With my help, his shirt went up and over his shoulders. I started to fold it neatly. He snatched it away, balled it up, and threw it into the corner. "Later," Matthew said impatiently, his hands moving once more over my body. Broad expanses of skin touched skin for the first time, warm and cold, in a meeting of opposites. It was my turn to laugh, delighted by how perfectly our bodies fit. I traced his spine, my fingers sweeping up and down his back until they sent Matthew diving down to capture the hollow of my throat and the tips of my breasts with his lips. My knees started to soften, and I grabbed his waist for support. More inequity. My hands traveled to the front of his soft pajama bottoms and undid the tie that kept them up. Matthew stopped kissing me long enough to give me a searching look. Without breaking his stare, I eased the loosened material over his hips and let it fall. "There," I said softly. "Now we're even."
"Not even close," Matthew said, stepping out of the fabric.
I very nearly gasped, but bit my lip at the last moment to keep the sound in. Nevertheless, my eyes widened at the sight of him. The parts of him that hadn't been visible to me were just as perfect as those that had. Seeing Matthew, naked and gleaming, was like witnessing a classical sculpture brought to life. Wordlessly, he took my hand and led me toward the bed. Standing beside its curtained confines, he jerked the coverlet and sheets aside and lifted me onto the high mattress. Matthew climbed into bed after me. Once he'd joined me under the covers, he lay on his side with his head resting on his hand. Like his position at the end of yoga class, here was another pose that reminded me of the effigies of medieval knights in English churches. I drew the sheets up to my chin, conscious of the parts of my own body that were far from perfect. "What's wrong?" he frowned.
"A little nervous, that's all."
"About what?"
"I've never had sex with a vampire before."
Matthew looked genuinely shocked. "And you're not going to tonight either." The sheet forgotten, I raised myself on my elbows. "You come into my bath, watch me get out of it naked and dripping wet, let me undress you, and then tell me we're not going to make love tonight?"
"I keep telling you we have no reason to rush. Modern creatures are always in such a hurry," Matthew murmured, drawing the fallen sheet down to my waist. "Call me old-fashioned if you'd like, but I want to enjoy every moment of our courtship."
I tried to snatch the edge of the bedding and cover myself with it, but his reflexes were quicker than mine. He inched the sheet lower, out of my reach, eyes keen. "Courtship," I cried indignantly. "You've already brought me flowers and wine. Now you're my husband, or so you tell me." I flicked the sheets off his torso. My pulse quickened once more at the sight of him.
"As a historian, you must know that scores of weddings weren't consummated immediately."
His attention lingered over my hips and thighs, making them cold, then warm, in an entirely pleasant fashion.
Years of courtship were required in some cases.
Most of those courtships led to bloodshed and tears. I put a slight emphasis on the word in question. Matthew grinned and stroked my breast with feather-light fingers until my gasp made him purr with satisfaction.
I promise not to draw blood if you promise not to weep.
It was easier to ignore his words than his fingers.
"Prince Arthur and Catherine of Aragon," I said triumphantly, pleased at my ability to recall relevant historical information under such distracting conditions. "Did you know them?"
"Not Arthur. I was in Florence. But Catherine, yes. She was nearly as brave as you are. Speaking of the past..."
Matthew drew the back of his hand down my arm. "What does the distinguished historian know about bundling?" I turned on my side and slowly extended my fingertip along his jawbone. "I'm familiar with the custom. But you are neither Amish nor English. Are you telling me that, like wedding vows, the practice of getting two people into bed to talk all night but not have sex was dreamed up by vampires?"
"Modern creatures aren't only in a hurry, they're overly focused on the act of sexual intercourse. It's far too clinical and narrow a definition. Making love should be about intimacy, about knowing another's body as well as your own."
"Answer my question," I insisted, unable to think clearly now that he was kissing my shoulder. "Did vampires invent bundling?"
"No," he said softly, his eyes glittering as my fingertip rounded his chin.
He nipped at it with his teeth. As promised, he drew no blood.
"Once upon a time, we all did.
The Dutch, and then the English came up with the variation of putting boards between the intended couples. The rest of us did it the old-fashioned way. We were just wrapped in blankets, shut into a room at dusk and let out at dawn."
"It sounds dreadful," I said sternly.
His attention drifted down my arm and across the swell of my belly. I tried to squirm away, but his free hand clamped onto my hip, keeping me still.
"Matthew," I protested.
"As I recall," he said, as if I hadn't spoken, "it was a very pleasant way to spend a long winter's night. The hard part was looking innocent the next day."
His fingers played against my stomach, making my heart skip around inside my ribcage. I eyed Matthew's body with interest, picking my next target. My mouth landed on his collarbone while my hand snaked down along his flat stomach.
"I'm sure sleep was involved," I said, after he found it necessary to snatch my hand and hold it away for a few minutes. My hip free, I pressed the length of my body against him. His body responded, and my face showed my satisfaction at the reaction.
"No one can talk all night."
"Ah, but vampires don't need to sleep," he reminded me, just before he pulled back, bent his head, and planted a kiss below my breastbone.
I grabbed his head and lifted it. "There's only one vampire in this bed. Is this how you imagine you'll keep me awake?"
"I've been imagining little else from the first moment I saw you."
Matthew's eyes shone darkly as he lowered his head.
My body arched up to meet his mouth. When it did, he gently but firmly turned me onto my back, grabbing both of my wrists in his right hand and pinning them to the pillow.
Matthew shook his head. "No rushing, remember?"
I was accustomed to the kind of sex that involved a physical release without needless delay or unnecessary emotional complications. As an athlete who spent much of my time with other athletes, I was well acquainted with my body and its needs, and there was usually someone around to help me fill them. I was never casual about sex or my choice of partners, but most of my experiences had been with men who shared my frank attitude and were content to enjoy a few ardent encounters and then return to being friends again as though nothing had happened. Matthew was making it clear that those days and nights were over. With him, there would be no more straightforward sex, and I'd had no other kind. I might as well be a virgin. My deep feelings for him were becoming inextricably bound with my body's responses, his fingers and mouth tying them together in complicated, agonizing knots. "We have all the time we need," he said, stroking the undersides of my arms with his fingertips.
weaving love and physical longing together until my body felt tight.
Matthew proceeded to study me with the rapt attention of a cartographer who found himself on the shores of a new world. I tried to keep up with him, wanting to discover his body while he was discovering mine, but he held my wrists firmly against the pillows. When I began to complain in earnest about the unfairness of this situation, he found an effective way to silence me. His cool fingers dipped between my legs and touched the only inches of my body that remained uncharted.
"Matthew," I breathed, "I don't think that's bundling."
"It is in France," he said complacently, a wicked gleam in his eyes. He let go of my wrists, convinced, quite rightly, that there would be no attempts to squirm away now, and I caught his face in my hands. We kissed each other long and deep. While my legs opened like the covers of a book, Matthew's fingers coaxed